With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's most family-friendly podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorales. This is the show we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show we have an interdisciplinary social scientist, almost got that right, working across a variety of fields including new media studies, religion and East Asia. He was born in Seoul but then moved to New York before going to Singapore and then ending up where he's now in Perth. He is an author of multiple books including the most recent Interfacing Death, Living in Global Uncertainty, and is a senior lecturer of anthropology and sociology at UWA. Thanks for being on the show, Dr. Sam Hahn. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks, George, for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. Yes, it's great to have you on. We've had a bit of pre-game chat, so I feel like I'm going to have to try to remind myself what we've chatted about, what we haven't yet. But maybe the first thing I would want to do, just so everyone can be clear on it, could you like just quickly in like 1 second clarify the difference between sociology and anthropology?
Yep, and this is going to be worse than Wikipedia, but the shorthand is that both are the study of humans. Anthropology is oftentimes defined by the study of humans through culture, and sociology is often defined by the study of humans through its organizations and institutions. And one of the ways that that distinction is made is by looking at who we study. So anthropologists oftentimes study what are called quote-unquote traditional societies, whereas sociology studies quote-unquote modern societies. Obviously, those are value judgments and problematic terms, but nevertheless, that's sort of the shorthand that we've used for a long time. But there's a whole bunch of crossover, and they're really twin disciplines. They emerge out of a similar sort of orientation to the world, which is that human beings oftentimes create their own worlds, and it's worth looking at those worlds that we've created to have a better sense of who we are.
Right, yeah. And like, I guess, when you're saying that, it actually makes me think of a few things, because first I hadn't actually separated them out like that, the difference between culture and institutions which exist and are a result of and yet feed into, because I think of like immediately institutions that kind of reinforce a culture, which I'm sure you've probably got a million examples, but the one that springs to mind for me whenever I think of this is France, and it's quite strong effort to maintain French language as separate to English. So all these English words that come in, from my understanding, they keep trying to make a French version of it. So like the internet has a different, like all these words have a French word essentially. Yeah. So I guess that's kind of interesting example of institutions forcing culture, I guess.
Right. In some ways you can say that it is an institution meant to preserve culture. But of course that means, and anthropologically you then ask the question, whose culture, which culture, from when, who gets to make these decisions? Because obviously in the case of France, the people who are appointed to the academy, who maintains, you know, what is considered French, what is not, you know, they also have their own sort of biases and positionalities. And I think all that in 2020, all of that has sort of come to the fore, the politics of museums, the politics of gathering knowledge about other people, that's all come to a fore. But yes, I think, you know, in France, there's a strong history, I would say, of preserving Frenchness, whatever that may mean.
Yeah, and I guess like that's where I'm torn about it, because I actually don't mind it. Like I think I look at certain, like especially in the face of globalization, which obviously is fantastic from getting people, lifting people out of a poverty point of view. But like it almost, sometimes I look at the mass media of globalization and like the way it kind of drowns out local cultures in their own distinct way. And like, it's like, yeah, it's cool. You can eat at every restaurant where you are, but like, it almost takes away from that distinct feature, which, and so that's why when I think of something like France and what they're doing, I guess you're right about the problematic nature, but at the same time, I don't mind that effort to be more distinct, if that makes sense.
No, I think the impulse is something that a lot of people share. It's a matter of who gets to say what France is, right? So right now, as you probably know, in France, there's been a decades-long debate around Islam and around head covering and about religious symbolism in public. So for instance, if Catholicism is viewed as French culture, well, then how come Islam isn't? There are plenty of French citizens who are practicing Muslims, yet somehow Islam is seen as identifiably un-French, whereas a crucifix is, you know? And I think, you know, in many ways, these discussions are worth having now because, like I said, I'm all for preserving Frenchness as long as people who actually live and embody Frenchness have a say in what that means, as opposed to a bunch of 80-year-old, you know, men, inevitably, you know, 80-year-old straight men who get to say what they think France is, but that's not necessarily what's happening in the streets, in the banlieues, in, you know, regional France. So yeah, I agree. The impulse is great. It's execution. And I guess that's the case with everything. The impulse is great. It's how do we pull that off?
Without, yeah, inevitably turning into a dictatorship, yeah, a cultural dictatorship, right. And actually, even as you say that, I do think of, actually, this will kind of relate to the book, as well as where you're from, and, like, I think the fact you started in Korea and you've grew up in America, which I think is really interesting because you were one when you moved from Seoul to the Bronx, which means, like, you are obviously very American at this point, but, like, you would have had a very, very deep appreciation of Korean culture, and that would have impacted you, because as someone who's the child of Greek immigrants who both were born there, although I wasn't born there, so they were a bit older, it definitely leaves its fingerprints all over you, I feel like.
Yeah, I know. It kind of sets you apart from, you know, folks around you, for sure. Mm,
which is definitely going to, but which ties to the book. But before we go to that one last, because with this cultural institutionalization topic, because as an American, I think you guys stand, like America stands as the most interesting example in some ways, because I don't think you've ever seen anywhere, like they were so rich but so late to the game culturally that there was this very, very, it feels like almost a concerted effort on their part to establish culture and norms, which is, the more I look at the history of the States and realize just how not one place they are, like, at all historically, the idea of them imposing cultural, like, regularities, it seems to me like the most interesting in a way, because all these other countries, like, they probably have a deeper, they've been around for thousands of years, they've got stuff which is like more to lean on, whilst America really did have to make a conscious decision in some ways to be like, what are we going to pick as our thing? Is that an assessment which...
No, absolutely. But I think one of the things we have to remind ourselves of is that the United States obviously is a settler colony that doesn't acknowledge itself as a settler colony. You know, I think those decisions, the newness that America proclaims is off the back of genocide and then chattel slavery of folks in Africa. So in many ways, the kind of decision-making that occurred is always post facto, and it's always going to be a bit romantic. And listen, you probably know as a child of immigrants, and I know as an immigrant myself, it's easy to get lost in that kind of hope of the new country. But, you know, we have to be very clear, especially as a person of color in America, it's clear that people who look like me did not even have the right to vote not that long ago, that people had to get their heads smashed in. So it's clear to me that the institutionalization of what it is to be American is a decision that is obviously racialized, right? And it's politically quite violent, even though it feels good. You know, the flag, the anthem, hot dogs, hamburgers, you know, that stuff. It feels good. And we all get caught up in it, for sure. You know, I grew up in the 80s, you know, thinking I was G.I. Joe, you know what I mean? Not knowing that, you know, the country that my parents left is one of the last remnants of the Cold War. And here I am growing up as I think I'm Sergeant Slaughter or whatever. But all that's complicated. But I think in America, all those processes are on the surface because, you know, America for various reasons, makes those processes quite public. And that's something I do appreciate. I think Americans oftentimes are quite frank and blunt about these things, whereas I think in other places is less so. And I think that openness allows for contestation as opposed to there being a single story and everyone having to stick to it.
Hmm. Yeah, and then, and again, as your own studies would say, how much of that was planned and how much of that, which cultures, yeah. It's like I was reading about like geography and that's impact on how societies develop, but just so specifically, are you next to a mountain or not? And that's going to just change everything in a culture. But I'm already going off on too many different tangents. Let's look, we'll go to the book and we'll jump around from there, I think, because I am excited to talk about this. So your book of choice for today is?
Is the photographer Robert Frank's probably magnum opus. It's called The Americans.
Mm. Which is essentially a collection of photos. It's a photo journal, I suppose, of his time in late 50s America, doing a cross-country look at, I don't want to say middle America, because that's probably not the right term, but just people who are not the fancy and glamorous stuff, but yeah, like that.
Well,
but
you not know, also well, trying- a little bit of that. It's not excluded. There are some images of, you know, Hollywood movie premieres, you know, high society in New York. So yeah, it's the broad swath of America. And as you note, he takes a trip. He takes a trip across America, which is also a very American thing.
Yeah. Especially, yeah. The whole, because when I was looking this up before starting, I noticed that, Jack Kerouac was the, he gave the foreword, which one of the very famous beat poets. And yeah, his stuff is all about that, the journey and the romanticization of that. Because that is a very more distinct American thing, I think, that whole idea of the journey across the country like that. Because, yeah, you can't travel in Europe, you can't travel an hour without being in a new country. So, yeah.
Exactly. And I think in many ways in Europe, the kind of, the infrastructural or the transportation, the image, the figure is the train, the streetcar. Whereas in America, it's the automobile. And Robert Frank, who was a Swiss immigrant who came to the United States, won a Guggenheim Fellowship. And he basically traveled across the country documenting regular people, which was a very radical idea for a photographer in the 50s. And I mean regular people. And it's called The Americans because some of these images just capture what it means to live in America and its various strata, you know, not just high society, not just the poor, but across it all. And I think there's a certain kind of, like we were just discussing about our own experiences as immigrants or as children of immigrants, there's a certain kind of immigrant viewpoint that Frank's images demonstrate. And I think that's the beauty of it. And I think that's why Kerouac was so intrigued by it as well. I think Kerouac being not only a beat, but I think in many ways a romantic about travel. You know, I think Kerouac was taken by Frank's ability to sort of slip into a place, capture it, and then keep going. And that's something that I think immigrants in particular are prone to or are good at, because obviously we've left home and tried to create a new home, but it's never going to be home. And I think that kind of diasporic condition bleeds through every single of the 83 images in this book.
Yeah, and I think that point as well, like the fact that he was Swiss and coming to America and seeing it with kind of different outsider eyes, which obviously, yeah, like you said, it's interesting that you would find such appeal in that, I guess. Was that something that you felt a bit growing up? Like, and again, I guess because of America's standing, I would say, whilst it is obviously very new, it has had put a lot more work into being a more distinctly its own cultural thing, which I would say now when people think of America, there are contrasting and but iconography that's attached to it more so than for somewhere like Australia, which I feel like is even newer and yep. younger and hasn't had that kind of concentrated focus either to define itself so clearly. So for me, it's very easy to be like, it's weird for me sometimes being in Australia because as a person like with a Greek background, it's very easy for me to be like, oh, I'm Greek Australian and not feel the conflict because everyone here is from somewhere else a lot of the time it feels
right.
like. But for you growing up, obviously that wouldn't have been as distinct maybe. So
no,
yeah.
well, because I think in many ways I was fortunate enough that my parents actually, the way that my family came to the US was my mother's sister had already been living in Los Angeles. And at the time, you could sponsor a family member. So my aunt sponsored us and we arrived in Los Angeles. And then for some reason, my father heard that there was work in El Paso, Texas. So we were in El Paso, Texas for maybe half a year. And then my father worked at a dog food factory and he thought it's tough. There aren't other Korean people around. El Paso is a border town. And he thought, you know what, we got to get out of here. So he made the call, and you know, I don't know if he made the call. Maybe it was my mother. I don't know the story exactly, but you know, we finally went to another place. So Los Angeles at the time was the hub of Korean American life, and the other hub was New York City. So, you know, they figured, you know what, we got to be around other Korean folks. We got to be able to communicate. You know, neither of my parents went to university. They didn't really have an education. So they went to New York. So for me, growing up in New York was quite distinct because I knew from a very young age that the America that I lived in was not the America that I saw on television. You know what I mean? So all that to say, growing up in the Bronx in the 80s, I lived in a Korean enclave. You know, I went to a Korean church. My neighborhood was Korean. My school wasn't very Korean, but there were people from all over. I always joke, I really never had met a non-ethnic white American until I got to university. You know what I mean? But that's only because we lived in New York. You know what I mean? And in New York, no one is really a non-ethnic white American. There aren't that many of those around, really. So I didn't think it was that weird because I go to my friends' houses in elementary school. They're speaking a different language at home. They've got weird food happening. They got a funny grandma like me, you know? So it didn't seem all that weird. It's a different version of the life that I led as well. So that sort of feeling out of step. Yeah. Like if I watch television and I'm watching, you know, like Growing Pains and I'm like, wow, that's an American family. I don't see those, you know, certainly my family's not like that, but my neighbor's family isn't like that either. So the kind of feel being embedded in a community full of smaller ethnic communities made it feel like, yeah, I guess this is how it is. Only later did I realize, oh, we're living in a very specific cultural context in New York City, you know?
Yeah. It's, sounds quintessentially New Yorker as well, I would be like, mm-hmm. Oh, there's another place apart from New York. Okay.
Exactly.
Doesn't sound as good.
I know. And that's the thing. I still have that in me where I'm like, everything is second. You know, like the ideal type is already set, so nothing can ever come close. And, you know, that's such a, it's a ridiculous New York thing, but I can't help it. It's a condition. You know, I wear it as a part of my neurosis.
Yeah. Talking about like culture propagating, institutions which propagate culture, I feel like that's one of the bigger, the romanticization of New York has been.
Oh, but listen, George, I can go on and on about how wonderful New York is, but I can also go on and on about how crap New York is. But that's a New York thing as well. Because, you know, we're so self-involved. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the best and the worst. It's the best of times.
You have to claim both. You can't just have one. No, sorry, you're second worst, actually.
No,
sorry.
Of course, because it's a New Yorker's job. It's a point of pride to be able to kvetch about how horrible New York is.
I know. That's the part where you're like, although, see, look, here's my take. If I was going to give a take on New York from my very limited time there, I feel like the issue I have with New York, I'll be honest, and everyone's love of it, is that it's changed from the 80s to the 90s to now. So anyone who's claiming the things they claim like it's the 80s or the 90s, it's like, it's not. So especially now, I feel like it's so sold out. Like Manhattan is like, it's just,
oh, yeah, yeah.
You can't get mugged in Manhattan if you tried. Like,
no,
you see,
there is,
it's not what it was. So when people walk around and they're saying, oh, it's the best and the worst, it's like, are you still thinking of it like the 90s where maybe it was more distinct? But now it's gentrified on a whole scale, which I think,
having lived through that, it's a stark contrast. It is a stark contrast. But again, it's home. And as you know, it's like, home, like you're not an objective observer of home. You know what I mean? It's like family. You know, it's like, I don't, you know what? My opinion's always going to be biased because I'm in it, you know?
And I can make fun of it, but you can't, all right?
No. I'm sort of ecumenical about this. Listen, New York is a hard place to live. So if you can do 10 years in New York, you got it. You can claim to be a New Yorker. I'm not one of these people that's a purist because it's hard, man. So it's like, you know what? If you can do it for a decade, that's you. You can claim it. Go ahead.
Ah, man, it's hard everywhere, you bloody New Yorkers. God, it's called life.
No, I would say living in Perth, not that hard.
Okay,
and come on, George. Come on, George. In Australia, I learned a very important phrase here. Too easy. Everything is too easy.
Look, we can go into the sad, slowly filtering problem with that. But yeah, no, look, you're totally
no,
right.
Exactly.
It is nice. When you can just go for a run at lunch and like you're next to the most beautiful water on a beautiful thing and the air is so clean.
Yep.
And then, it's nice. I will agree with that. Yep. But to go back to the book now, I guess, because it's funny you're saying all this immediately, obviously makes very clear in an almost boringly obvious psychological way of why you would be interested in sociology and anthropology, because it sounds like it was something you we're aware of the whole time, almost, like, especially sitting there in your ethnic community. Is that fair to say? Like, you didn't switch to it. You kind of were always.
Yes. I just didn't have a name for it. You know, I think, you know, we all had to sort of be sociologists or anthropologists growing up because, you know, you're living amongst folks who are seemingly so different from you, but also so similar to you. And that's kind of, you know, it's a trip, you know, you're like, whoa, like, how are these folks so different, but so similar? And I think trying to kind of reckon with that was the kind of first spark of my sociological imagination. And just to tell you a bit more about my background, I was fortunate enough to, I went to public schools in New York for the first, up until sixth grade. And in seventh grade, which is middle school in the States, I was part of a program for, called Prep for Prep. I was lucky enough to go to, you know, one of the most kind of prestigious private schools in New York City on scholarship. And sort of seeing that distinction, that dichotomy, and that school that I went to was also in the Bronx. So to have grown up in the Bronx and then to be kind of exposed to a different world, but, you know, just a bus ride away, it made me really kind of, you know, stretch my social scientific imagination. Like, what's going on here? How is it that these folks exist in a very small area? And I had no idea that they were there. I didn't know that this world had existed. So yes, I think in many ways, sociology was simply me figuring out my place in the world.
Right. And like, was it still ethnic basis in that private school as well? Or was that?
No. So that private school was probably 80% Jewish. It was a specific kind of private school. It's called the Ethical Culture Fieldston School. And it's known as one of the most progressive private schools in New York City. To kind of give you a picture of it, it's sort of like what we would call in the States, like a limousine liberal school or like a champagne socialist school. So people who are quite wealthy, but kind of very left wing, send their kids there. And that's why when I was in school, you know, I think somewhere around 30% of the student body was of color. So it's one of these places that, you know, is very expensive to go to, but they have progressive values and things like that. So it was perfect for me. I loved it.
It worked out great for you.
No, absolutely. But I mean, the contrast, it was so different, you know, like in sixth grade, my middle school, my public middle school had metal detectors because kids were bringing in guns and knives. And then I walk into a school where it costs someone 17 grand at the time to send their kid there. You know what I mean? It was a complete 180.
Yeah. That's a, that's really going to spark that kind of, the look you had. So I guess to look at that further, in terms of this book, The Americans, when did you first see this book, I guess?
Ooh, so at this school, one of the amazing things was the kind of investment in arts education. So in middle school, so for seventh and eighth grade, we had to do all the arts, dance, music, photography, printmaking.
It's the most liberal school of
Yeah, it was amazing because, you know, it's that American thing where you have to be a well-rounded individual. It's that sort of liberal arts tradition, right? Where, oh no, you can go off and do whatever you want, but you need to be well-versed in the arts, in dance, in music, etc. So I remember studying photography in eighth grade. And, you know, when you learn photography, and this is, you know, obviously, this was pre-digital, you know, we all had to learn how to shoot film. We had to develop film. We had to do all that. And I remember, and we only shot black and white, really. And I remember encountering this book in eighth grade because it's a classic. This is a classic in what's now called documentary photography, photojournalism. I would say it's the precursor to street photography, which really explodes in the 60s and 70s. So I remember looking at these images and just being taken by them. You know, it's aesthetic quality, it's messiness, but also the kind of the meaning behind it, and not a singular meaning, you know, you can look at the image and get so many different things out of it. And you're looking at all parts of the frame. It's full. And so poetic, you know, to me, and Kerouac uses that term in his introduction to the book, it's poetry. He says, if you don't like poetry, you don't like these pictures. And I remember just in eighth grade being like, whoa, I didn't know you can do this with photography. So it was really in eighth grade where I first encountered it. I didn't really understand what was going on, you know, but I thought it was cool. Only later did I, you know, come back to it thinking, whoa, there's a lot here.
Yeah, like as in the deeper meaning than just like seeing the rawness of it and all that. So did you, have you maintained an interest in photography since then?
So this is so interesting. I mean, I've always loved photographs, you know, just looking at photographs. And, you know, I didn't take pictures for a long time. So after eighth grade, I stopped. It's only during the first kind of lockdowns here in Perth. We weren't in lockdown for very long, but in 2020,
so long where, 4 days.
I know. It was like a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, during those periods where, you know, you can only go out, you know, with one or two other people in your household and you can only go out for an hour, where I was like, you know what, maybe I should start taking photos again. So I bought like a camera and I really just started doing it, and I would go every day, and then I caught the bug again. And, you know, I really sort of immersed myself. And after our lockdowns were lifted, I really just started hitting the streets. It was so therapeutic. It felt so good. Only because, you know, during the pandemic, everyone is so atomized. Everyone's so individuated, right? And once we were kind of back out, you felt connected to the world because you're looking for certain things. And I think growing up, I've always been interested in the details. You know, one of the things, as a sociologist in particular, you know, you get to see that the small things mean a lot, you know, like, you know, nowadays there's a lot of talk on the internet and otherwise around the notion of a microaggression, right? And that's to me quite interesting because I think it elevates and sort of expands our understanding of racism. Racism isn't simply not being allowed in one space or not being given an opportunity based on one's skin color, ethnic background or whatever. It's in the small things, like being asked, where are you from? No, where are you really from, right? So in those small details, it's what I've always been interested in as a scholar. But, you know, with a camera walking around, you get to capture those small details. And I felt like, I don't know, I just felt reinvigorated. So in 2020, I just started taking so many photos. I just went nuts. And it was, I think it was a form of therapy, you know? So it's only recently that I've rediscovered photography. So that's when I, you know, bought a whole spate of photo books to kind of re-educate myself, re-immerse myself.
Right. So just apart from that, like kind of class in year eight, since then you didn't actually take any lessons or anything. It's been more just self-teaching recently for that.
And just, recently and just appreciating photographs. I've always appreciated photographs.
Okay. Well, that's like, I'm glad because I actually would want to ask this question, which might be bad or like dumb, I don't know. But with this specific book, because it keeps talking, and like my theory is, I think I know the answer, but it keeps talking about the rawness of the photos. And this is a distinct feature of them, which I do want to talk about that as well. But the part that I think is interesting is, are they good photos? Like from your professional point of view, are they actually good photo, like oh, you just took a snap, and it's like it makes it sound casual and it's just a raw moment, but like obviously you can do that and then the person's half chewing and blurry and it's not that good, or you can do that and it's raw but it's also a good photo. So is that like part of the appeal of this? Is it distinct in that sense?
Well, I think George, you're wrong. That's a good question. That's not a stupid question at all. That's a good question. That is the question. I think Frank is responsible for what is called the snapshot aesthetic. So prior to Frank, prior to the 50s, people took very technically sound photographs, right? Everything is in perfect focus. The lighting is perfect. The exposure is perfect. What Frank was able to do was basically rewrite what we understand to be a good photograph, right? Because I think what Frank basically was able to do was he was able to capture moments, right? And fleeting moments where we can find beauty not simply in the lighting, the subject, the framing, but the moment itself. So I think when I look at Frank's photographs, I think, oh, he's capturing moments, right? And that's what he cares about. He's not interested necessarily in a technically good photo. Some of them, and to be honest, these photographs were not seen as very good photographs by the photographic establishment. In fact, he couldn't get an American publisher. These photographs were first published in a book in France, and they were accompaniment to text. It's only when those images in France gained some kind of traction that an American publisher said, hey, we should put this out on its own. And I think in many ways, what Frank was able to do was to say, well, what do we mean by a good photograph, right? Because what's, for me, a good photograph is a photograph that you can linger on, that you can look at over and over and over again and discover something new. And it's not necessarily about beauty, or rather it's about rethinking what beauty is, because all of this is about, as you said, rawness. And by rawness, it's not staged. You know, these moments are just moments that he came came upon. And I think that's such a, and I don't want to sound cheesy, but that's such a democratic thing that you and I can have in our phones. We have very sophisticated phones now, right? Our cameras are quite good that we can just be taking a walk and encounter a scene and snap an image, right? And that's all that matters. For Frank, it's putting in the hours, it's traveling, it's being open to moments. It's not about whether you know how to work a piece of machinery, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I love that. I love how democratic that ethos is, which is that it's not about fancy equipment. Of course, if you have fancier equipment, you have better photos technically. But is it a moment? Is it something that you want to keep looking at? Maybe, maybe not. And that's not determined by how expensive your camera is. You know, that's determined by your eye, you know, and your eye is not simply your eye, but about, I think, your attitude, you know, your orientation to the world. And I love that. I think for, we can see here that Frank has a certain orientation to the country.
Yeah. No, like it's a bit of what I was talking about, but also like, I think the idea that, because I just want to imagine, I'm picturing someone who hasn't seen this and we're talking about this and they don't know what this is. Mm. And because, especially since then, which I actually hadn't thought about the fact that he started that, which I think is a meeting of technology and timing as much as anything else, which I do want to talk about with you as well.
Yeah.
Just in terms of the fact that, yeah, any of us can capture a raw moment and it might even be a good scene, but some of those photos still don't actually capture it that good. You look at it afterwards, you're like, fuck, that was such a good moment, but that isn't actually that good a photo of capturing that. And I would say what makes him good as well, because I'm guessing even on this tour across America, he probably took thousands of photos.
Yeah,
and then
he's thousands.
Picked, yeah, so then he's picked the ones which do that. So yes, I guess in that sense, they're still filtered through something. So it's technically raw, because then it's perfectly capturing that moment, I guess, is what I mean. Yeah, which...
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it's a meeting of technology and aesthetic orientation. In many ways, Frank used the Leica, and Leica was the first sort of handheld camera. Because if you imagine the history of photography, it started in studios, right? Where you have a giant, you know, frame, and that's the negative. You know, it's like 4x5, you know? And you know, you have to be very still. It's like those family portraits that, you know, people take, right? But to have something as small as this, right? I'm showing a picture of a camera, and to be able to walk around and just snap images, right? It's a different thing, because that means there's a certain degree of mobility. And of course, you know, like, he's traveling across the country and he's taking thousands. I believe he took tens of thousands of photographs, and only 83 are in this book. And I think in many ways, you're right. It's how to match that sort of content and form. You know, he's looking for something, obviously. And I'm sure there are plenty of amazing moments that just didn't come out right. You got the exposure wrong. Somebody was moving or whatever it is. But that's the discipline. That's the practice. For me, to be able to taking photographs is the point in making photographs. You know, because the hit rate is so low. Anyone who's taken any photographs before, someone who's even taken photographs at like a friend's birthday party, they know that it's probably what, 1 or 2 out of 36, you know, that hit rate is very low. But that's what you're chasing, you know, that once in a while you'll catch a stray. And that's fun. It's like a gamble. And I'm sure in the film era, it was more of a gamble, because you can't even preview the image. You're just hoping to God that something develops, you know. And I think it's amazing. You know, it's this work, and Frank generally, I think, is someone who just put in the time, like did the work. Because if there are 83 of these images, who knows how many were left on the cutting room floor?
Yeah.
Tens of thousands. Yeah.
Yeah. That's I agree 100% with your thing. It makes me think of whenever I go traveling, I love taking plenty of photos. But one thing I'm always very militant about is sitting there as much as possible, usually to be frank, sometimes on the toilet, but just going through and just cutting, because like, if you don't do it at the time, you're going to end up your trip with 50 trillion photos and whatever. So I've slowly developed like this style. My one is always, if they're at all close, you'd be like, which one are these? Just instead of looking at 10, just look at 2 always. Just which one's better of these two? And then delete. My goal is to eventually have one photo that sums up my whole life that's better than all the rest. That's
it. I love that.
The perfect photo.
That's amazing. Well, people say that about writing, right? Writing is always rewriting. You know, it's always editing, right? Faulkner has that famous line, you have to kill your darlings, right? And basically what he's getting at is that you can't grow attached to your words, because a good piece of writing is going to come from subtraction, not addition.
Yeah. And it's always going to be, and the better the stuff, the harder it's going to be that you still have to do it. Like, as in, as you especially get towards the end, it's going to get harder and harder.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To go into the technology side of things, because I only did a cursory glance at your list of books that you've written, but it seems like the interaction of technology with culture is a big part of your like history, or what you seem to really look at, especially these books all seem to be referencing technology interacting with different elements of culture, like you had religion and death and media. So this is, it's tangentially related, because I do look at, like, obviously he's, because firstly, it's so impossible to tease out any one strand with this stuff. Like, because in terms of, to go back to the book for a second, the fact that he was capturing that at that moment, which is late 50s America, which is just when all this stuff was happening anyway. So how can you separate out the technology from the people, like, all these voices that had previously gone unheard were very much the 60s, iconically in America, is where all those voices started shouting, essentially.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
The fact that he took these photos in 59, but that's just when those cameras became, like, it's just hard to tease out any one thing.
No, I think it's all there. It's all sort of amalgamated. And I think, I mean, just think about it. The 50s is that kind of, in the United States, when the post-war boom really occurred. So you have the rise of consumer products, you have, you know, automobile culture, you know, I think all of that kind of speaks to, and appliances are really kind of readily available for people. That sort of consumerism really emerges in the 50s in the United States. And I think there's, you know, those consumer products assume a certain kind of desire for people to want gadgets. You know, I mean, to us now, of course, like, you know, people are staying up late to see what the new Apple event's going to be. What's the, you know, what are the new specs for the new MacBook or the iPad or whatever, whatever. We're already kind of embedded in all that. But I think it's the 50s where a consumer orientation really emerges. And I think Frank kind of captures that as well. There's so many images from his car, of cars, et cetera. And I think that's quite revealing historically. And the 50s, obviously, with the consumerism, also is when you have the precursor to the 60s, right? You have the emergence of feminism. You have the emergence of civil rights. You've got all, and you have the emergence of the critique of consumerism. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, by the time the 60s come around and you have all the kind of student movements and the student protests, the 50s is really when all this is bubbling up, and it's only in the 60s that it emerges, that it kind of is desublimated, if you will. And I think the this comes out in 59. This comes out in 59, that transitional moment, right? Mm. So many of these images are about race. Of course, you know, anyone who comes to America, who looks at America without thinking about race, is not, you know, is not understanding reality. And I think Frank captures it in such a way, it's so striking. And I think it's that transition, right, that Frank points to. And I think the technological transition is also there. The 50s, again, you know, if you look at the cars, if you look at dishwashers, toaster ovens, all these things are all coming out, you know, in the 50s. And then by the 60s, you have full-blown consumer capitalism. You know, you have people buying stuff for the sake of buying stuff, right? And just to bring that to my scholarly interest in technology, you know, when we see something like digitization, right? And that sort of moment where everything can be done through something like a computer, work, play, entertainment, that obviously means something for how people interact with one another. What is culture if not a means of communication, right? And I think in many ways, if you have a technological revolution, quote unquote, like computerization, digitization, of course it's going to impact how we relate to one another. And I would go so far as to say how we relate to ourselves, what we mean by being human, right? One could even argue that the definition of the human is always a reflection of the dominant technologies, right? Like if we leave the house without our, if we leave the house without our cell phones, we feel naked. People say that all the time. Oh my God, I don't have my phone today. I feel naked. Isn't that interesting, right? That we're so reliant on this that this feels like clothing, like armor, right? Or people say, oh, I need to turn off my phone, screen time. Isn't that interesting? That so much of our world and our lives are attached to our phones, right? That we feel that we need to regulate that because we're so immersed. So surely this has some kind of impact, or it has to have an impact on anthropology and sociology. And I've always felt that way because having been born in the 80s and lived through the 90s and 2000s, I feel like I lived that period where, you know, I remember the day my family got cable television. I remember the day that we got cable internet, you know, broadband internet. So not having that as a default, right, makes me really think, whoa, things are changing as a result. Not only because technology has changed, but technology is, if not determining our situation, it's resetting what we mean by the default settings, if you will, right? How we communicate, how we relate to one another, all these things. And I think, of course, COVID has made that even clearer. But yeah, I've always been taken by what technology has done in a grand sense, but in a small granular sense, you know, like, you know, I remember walking around with my Walkman thinking this is the most incredible piece of technology ever. And now a Walkman, what is that? You know?
Ah, no, it's still amazing.
I agree.
It's due for a comeback as well, but no, that one, please. That's iconic. I was slightly older, I think, so I was more slightly younger, I mean. So for me, the Discman was more than the Walkman.
Right.
But,
or even that, to same be able sort of to thing. Carry music around, you know? Yeah.
And at least the I feel like the Walkman didn't skip as much. The Discman was always... So is this
problem, I know. You need to get the sports version.
Yeah. Otherwise, you tap it and it's like, skip. It's like, ah, come on. Mini disc. That's the future.
Yes. I remember mini discs. For a while.
Mainly because of my older brother loving that stuff. But I guess, so, and I don't know if this is a topic to even, I don't know what I'll be asking when I say this, but I guess one of the interesting things about this is that, yes, you've got the way we communicate with each other, which is obviously... That's now, especially the web is obviously the biggest change of that, I would say. I think it's bloody, it's everyone says it since the printing press, essentially, which is a bit different, but also kind of related because like when you look at something like the 50s, yes, you had phones and stuff and that kind of going that way. But what there was different as well, and I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this, was the capturing of it, which was really like a big change then. Like all of a sudden, that's part of these voices finding themselves because like all of a sudden you could see them. They weren't not seen before. So like that element of the technology, which I would say is very much happening now with Twitter and all that sort of thing and these live streaming, like is that a thing as well? And is that different? Do you see it as separate or the same or
No, I think so. I think in many ways the 50s is the beginning of consumer products. So the technology has always sort of been ahead of what's available on the consumer market, right? So, you know, people had cameras, except the only people who had cameras were professional photographers. It's only when it becomes available to the masses that it really makes an impact, right? So cameras, people finally in the 50s, I think it was still quite expensive to own a camera. But by the 60s and 70s, everyone was getting cameras, you know, documenting what's going on at home, documenting trips, et cetera. And I think that sort of relationship between consumption and sort of mass availability is really where technology makes an impact. It's not an accident, George, that Marshall McLuhan, the famous media theorist, writes his first book, Understanding Media, or not his first book, his most famous book. It's published in 1964, right? You know, just 5 years after the Americans. And I think that's not an accident because he's, and you know, his famous phrase is that the medium is the message, right? So it's not simply what's contained in you know, the message, but how the message is relayed that is as important, right? And I think it's really in that late 50s, early 60s moment where that sensibility is becoming popularized and people are really experiencing it because it's the kind of rise of television sets in the home. It's, as you said, the kind of the beginnings of a certain kind of technological orientation that we now are sort of living in fully. And I think a lot of that has to do with, to go back to your question, about who is able to produce and who is able to consume. And I think what we had in the 50s and 60s and 70s were people consuming things and just being able to produce a little bit. So you couldn't really make music, you know, unless you went to a professional studio, et cetera. Now, you know, you can make music on your phone. And I think that divide between production and consumption has slowly eroded and blended into one another. And one could arguably write the history of technology in the 20th century along those axes, production and consumption. Like now, it used to be, right, that producers were professional producers. They had to buy expensive equipment. They had to make it. They had to make big investments. And then they give it to us for us to consume. And we don't even want to produce. All we want is to consume. Now, we are able to produce and consume and distribute. And I think that sort of shift in the directionality of culture has been made possible by technological innovation, right? Mm. And surely that's going to have an impact on how we make meaning, how we communicate, how we define ourselves, how we understand the world in terms of scale, access, all those things. So I think we're living through very kind of interesting times when it comes to all this.
Right. So like, I guess to possibly ask you an unanswerable question, but what is the meaning that we're going to find out? What is the values? How is it going to change us, this new switch in your head? Like, I guess, because again, it's just, this does seem like a moment, which I'm guessing you could say this about any point in the last 50 years since the Americans came out, essentially. But it does feel like now we are very much mentally going through a shift because of this interaction with technology. So do you have any theories? I know, yes, some of your books seem to touch on elements of this.
Of course.
Do you have any theories?
Yeah, I think we've always, we've always been mediated through some sort of technology. But I think we were convinced that we were in control, right? That technology, science, were all, you know, serving humanity, so to speak. I think we're now living in an era, and I think in public discourse, this is very clear, that we're not so sure of whether technology is serving us, right? I'll just give you an example, George. Think about all the hand-wringing around Facebook, right? And about the kind of major deleterious effects Facebook has had in various parts of the world in terms of free elections, in terms of COVID misinformation, disinformation, et cetera. And think about all the criticisms that are, I think rightfully so, laid at the feet of Facebook. Because Facebook wants to have the influence and power without the responsibility. And of course, I don't know if you've kept up, there's recently been a whistleblower who used to work at Facebook who's given congressional testimony about how Facebook understood the impact that it was having on young girls in terms of body image, on various sorts of elections across the world, right? And what's interesting is many people who, you know, are way smarter about this than me have suggested that we need to start regulating Facebook just like we regulate the fossil fuel industry and how we used to regulate in America the tobacco industry, right? And in many ways, that's so different because I remember when I got Facebook for the first time, right? And I remember thinking, whoa, it's free? But we now realize that it's not free. There's always a cost, right? And I think that's where we're now seeing a different sort of understanding that technology isn't simply for us to use. Technology contains certain biases, certain values, certain proclivities that as a result of us interacting with it, we also take on to some degree. And I think having that awareness is a good thing. I think we're hopefully, I don't know if this is going to actually happen, but I think having that sort of understanding with the impact of technology or having that understanding of the impact of technology is always going to result in better outcomes because, you know, we can't simply just say, oh, well, Facebook, they're a media company, you know, it's free. Like, how can we regulate them? No. Facebook themselves, they understand the impact that they have on elections, you know, on people's body image. So if that's the case, well, then we need to have, as a society, a conversation about, well, how much are we willing to give over to them, right? Especially because Facebook wants to have the power and influence. They just don't want the responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, if they didn't want the power and responsibility, then fine. We won't regulate them. But if that's what they want, then hey, they got to play ball too.
I mean, this is, look, it's hard for me to kind of, so essentially, I would almost say a slight pushing back on an element of that, because I'd say the issue with Facebook is, and maybe this is literally impossible, but the idea that it's neutral in terms of, and that's why I would compare it to media, because I'm not even sure what the media rules are in America, but I would say it's almost like saying you can't have money able to influence the decision-making so much. So the issue right now isn't that it's neutral. It's the fact that whoever's got the most money can then spend the money on the campaigns, which can influence elections and influence thoughts and minds. So it's not neutral at all. It's actually just a wild west of unregulation where, like, anyone who's got the most power can then maintain that stance. And that's obviously goes against, when you can influence the actual policies from that, that goes against everything that democracy stands for, if you have any belief in it at all. It goes against even what the free market stands for, because it's no longer free at all. So if you're a free market proponent, or if you're a rabid socialist, either side, you'd be like, this isn't free at all. This is just completely one group controlling it. So the only people who would love it, I guess, are monarchists or dictator lovers, essentially.
Yeah, monopolists.
Yeah. So, like, as in that sense, yeah, I almost don't know if it's a reflection. Probably there are elements that tie in with human base instincts, which maybe we don't want to foster. But I would say the fundamental issue is that, the fact that it's almost opaque and that certain groups can do whatever they want, essentially, and get away with it. And that's obviously why Facebook might be tentative in changing it, because they pay money.
No, and I think that's exactly it. I think in many ways, Facebook is simply, it's not unusual. Facebook is exactly adhering to the logic of the world today. They're not doing anything different. You know, they're doing what every other company does, except they just have a billion plus users. You know what I mean? And that's why they're getting a lot of attention. I mean, think about it. Think about all the money in politics here in Australia, in America. All these companies are not catching heat like Facebook, because they just don't have the user base. You know what I mean? But Facebook has a massive user base, and their product is a media service, is, as opposed to, you know, think about, you know, the resources sector here in Australia, that basically are able to fly under the radar, even though it's pretty clear how it is that they're able to influence policy, for instance, right? And this goes all the way up. Think about, you know, all the backlash that Australia has gotten at COP26, right? So in many ways, Facebook is in the crosshairs, not because Facebook is unique, but because they have so much power and influence and a big user base. But they're not acting any differently than any of these large corporations, for sure.
Yeah, and I guess, and that's like where, I guess that's the issue more so than the technological factor, is the fact that it's just the big money interest issue, I guess, in that sense.
But I must say, the way that Facebook influences us is quite unique, right? Obviously, there have been a lot of studies, both in-house but by scholars, of the way in which scrolling on Instagram, for instance, affects us, right? All the messaging that can happen through algorithmic calculation, it's quite different. You know, the targeting that can occur, you know, because of course, Facebook tracks everything. When it is that you hover over an ad, when it is that you log on, when it is that you log off, you know, and they do all sorts of calculations. They algorithmically process all that, and they give you exactly what you want when you want it. That, I think, is quite unique, right? And I think that sort of dynamic is something that we need to have a broader cultural conversation around. Right? What is the nature of its influence, and whether we're comfortable with it? Because again, you know, I am not comfortable with the position, well, that's just what they do. They figured it out. Let them, you know, let them go wild. I don't think so. I don't think we, you know, if we believe in self-rule and sovereignty, right, then I think we can say to Facebook, hey, you need to make these changes, or we've agreed that we're only, you know, that you shouldn't be able to do these things, or you should be able to do these other things. I think those are, you know, conversations that are now happening, and I'm happy that they are happening. Yeah.
No, definitely. I agree. I think, just like I said, from any point of view, unless you just love dictators, that's the only reason I could think of.
Yeah, but George, there's a lot of people who do love dictators.
Look, they make you feel strong when you love a big man. You know, Give it to all those softies. Yeah.
I know.
That's the basis of my beliefs.
I know. You know, as someone, you know, who's, you know, who presumably knows something about people, I'm still like naive. I'm like, people like dictators? But yeah, it's you're right. It's appealing. It's comforting. They provide you security. So yeah, I think in many ways, what you said is correct.
Actually, on that point, it's because it's a book I read. It's one of those books that really stuck with me for a long time. And to be honest, maybe I've seeing what his position's been on other stuff has made me maybe think that I shouldn't hold it too high a standard. But Jonathan Haidt brought out a book called The Righteous Mind. Have you heard of it?
I know. No, I know who Jonathan Haidt is, but I haven't read that. I haven't read that book.
Yeah. So, I mean, he seems to be one of this school of... I agree with him a lot of stuff, and then it seems like he just goes in a wrong direction I'm not sure about. But he talks specifically about the idea that moral centers in human beings, or their ethical basis, the issue that a lot of the left in general has is that base everything on the idea of fairness and equality, but that's actually only one of, apparently, scientifically, where they've measured it, provable moral centers that people have. And actually, it's more like people have like different taste buds of morality is how the thesis he puts forward. And he narrows it down to like five, but also saying, obviously there's more than this, but here's five main ones. And like, yeah, one of them was about fairness, but then another one was about like a need for like authority figures and like a structure. Another one was about divinity versus humanity. And that was, and then another one was like about filth, like cleanliness versus like filthiness. Like, and they would just do all these tests to kind of, these very broad labels, but seeing as people would base their morality on these things. So like, how much divine are you? How clean are you? How structured are you? And that was where modern, let's say more liberal thinkers would be mistaken, because they only focus on the fairness doctrine rather than on these other forms of morality that seem to actually be a real cornerstone of how people think.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. I think in many ways, the problem with classical liberalism, and by liberalism, I mean with a lowercase L, you know, that liberal, not politically liberal, but I mean liberal as in, you know, what modern Western culture is, the belief in the individual, the belief in reason, the belief in science. I think one of the kind of problems with that model is that it assumes that everyone is acting in good faith, and that if you educate them enough and give them enough information, they will make the right decision. I don't think that's true necessarily, because there's certain elements of who we are where we're quite capable of doing really bad things, right? Hannah Arendt, who was, you know, one of the most kind of prescient kind of thinkers in the 50s, wrote about the banality of evil. And what she's talking about is Nazism, that evil doesn't emerge because people are evil. Evil emerges because people are just following orders. They're unthinking, right? So to prevent evil is to not get rid of this metaphysical, theological idea of evil, but it is to ensure that people are thinking twice about what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, just to bring it back to the Americans, the 50s was a period where people thought in America, we got it good. We came out unscathed. We won in World War II. And look it, we got so much stuff. We got cars. We got houses. We got lawns. We got picket fences. We got dogs. We got everything. Everything is great. And what Frank does is he goes across the country to show the fissures of American society just below the surface, in particular having to do with race, right? And I think that, to me, is wonderful about Frank, but I think it's the 50s that really does that, which is the 50s is the period where America for a long time, maybe other parts of the world, experienced a certain kind of positive vibes about how things were going. And after that, where he puts a critical lens, a literal critical lens on that idea of progress, the idea that everything's good, everything is shiny. And I think that's something that always appealed to me as a sociologist. It's what's under the surface, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, just to go back to what you were saying, it's not all about fairness. There's a lot under the surface having to do with resentment. Like you were saying about Haidt's work, that one of the kind of, criteria in that typology, not criteria, but one element of that typology has to do with cleanliness, desire for authority. I think those things, for like a person who believes in like the liberal project of the West, assumes that no. Who wants an authority figure? We all are autonomous, rational individuals. And I think those are people who have a very skewed understanding of human nature. I think anyone who's ever read Freud, for instance, would understand that. I think anyone who's ever read Camus would understand that. I think anyone who's ever been in love would understand that. But, there are plenty of people. Well, because I think in many ways, the experience of love or infatuation is a kind of giving up of the self, that you don't feel like yourself, right? You feel complete, and I think those are experiences that, we don't like to feel like we're out of control, right? And I think control is what the idea of control is what can give us the sense that we can be, fair. And I think I always operate from a position where, no, we have to, in spite of ourselves, try to be fair. Fairness is not something that is unlocking something that's already innate. It's in spite of my baseline unfairness that I have to try to create something like a just world. You know what I mean? Because I don't think that people just left to their own devices are going to create just and fair social orders. Historically speaking, that hasn't occurred. You know what I mean?
It's crazy for me to argue the sociologists and anthropologists on this, but I'd feel like that's almost at risk, because as someone who loves evolution, I always hear that argument that, man's actually brutish and we're left to our own devices, we're cruel and hierarchical. But I feel like history actually disproves that, whilst also, yes, a million examples of the opposite. But the fact is that, the most people actually are nice fundamentally, and it's just the messiness of life that can make us confused and misunderstood. And usually a lot of the time it can have to do with external forces playing on those base desires of us. So if you've got an understandable fear of your family being hurt, that can very quickly translate into you being angry at foreigners, let's say, for example, something like that. So I feel like a lot of time I don't want to let that go and just say, yeah, I agree 100%, because I don't fundamentally agree. Like, as in, I think people can too easily be like, it's dog eat dog, baby. We got to force the good. It's like, no, I think humans have we contain multitudes. And I think it can depend on the structures that we're within that can then twist those into good and bad, essentially. But no, I'd say
I totally agree with what you said. I think in many ways, for me, yes, everyone is nice, but does that create good outcomes? Because listen, let me tell you right now, if we took a survey of every Australian and asked, are you a racist? No one would say yes. Maybe a couple, but no one would say
definitely
yes.
Than a couple.
Yes, but George.
But not nowhere near the amount,
Exactly. But would you agree that racism exists in Australia? Certainly, because racism doesn't exist because there are racists. Racism exists because of, like you said, the social orders that we've created. So for me, whether people are nice or not nice is besides the point. Are we creating institutions, structures, and social orders that create a just world or a fair world, if that's what we want? We can agree and say, well, that's not what we want. Well, then let's just call it what it is. We want a fascist social order. But if indeed we want fairness and justice, right, then we have to also acknowledge, like you said, that whether we're nice or not is not going to create nice outcomes, because plenty of nice people do bad things. You know what I mean? I think that's the thing. And I think in many ways, our inclination towards, well, if I act nice, then nice outcomes will, occur. I think that's a result of this idea that if I really feel it on the inside, it'll kind of play out in the world. But as a sociologist, as someone who studies structures, I know that doesn't exist.
What I mean? You would have many examples, I feel like, of seeing.
Yes. That. And I think in many ways, in spite of ourselves, right? So in many ways, I'm asking for a certain kind of humility, a sociological humility. You know what? We have all these fancy things. We've got immense computing power. But the 20th century was the century where more human beings killed other human beings. Right now, in 2021, right? Almost 2022, the gap between the richest and the poorest is bigger than it's ever been. So, we're living under, extraordinary circumstances where humanity, quote unquote, has done a bunch of stuff. But guess what? That fundamental divide still hasn't been figured out. And that's not because we're not nice. In fact, I think it's because we think we're too nice. We need to start being real with ourselves. And like you were saying, we need to, understand ourselves perhaps as flawed, but that shouldn't spiral into a nihilism, like you said, because that is a danger. The spiraling into, well, it's dog eat dog. It is what it is. I'm going to get mine. I'm going to protect it. No, I think that's the wrong way about it. The right way is, we are all capable of doing some pretty bad stuff. And that's why we need to be good about what sorts of institutions. And institutions are nothing. Institutions are simply embodied structures of norms and values. And guess what? we determine norms and values, or we can, you know what I mean? But we got to do the work. But the tough thing is we got lives to lead. So it's hard, man.
Yeah. That's look. And, cause we probably should tie it off soon. I guess in that sense, a part of that is capturing what we actually are doing and who we actually are right now, which obviously the Americans did seems iconically back then, and I guess is what sociology and anthropology is all about.
I like how you put it there, George.
Yeah, yep. See, look, I'm all good at just tying it all together, baby.
You got it, baby. Yeah,
and
man,
just like it was printed in Korea. No, I don't know if that happened, but just trying to tie everything together at once. The only one tiny quick thing at the end, just because I want to know, in terms of like Robert Frank's work, do you see that still happening now, or is it happening now, but it's not seen as much, or it's happening now and it's seen so much that it's irrelevant? It's kind of what I'm seeding my own opinion, but do you see like, or where it's not happening, you think it would happen more, and the difference between countries, like, is there anything you want to talk to that? Because that's probably the last thing I'll say.
Yeah, no,
that's
a good question. I think the legacy of Frank is in the tradition of street photography. So Frank is seen as, you know, kind of really popularizing what's called a snapshot aesthetic. And then after Frank, I think there are kind of two trajectories. One is photojournalism, you know, like war photography, things like that, and then also street photography. So it's sort of capturing the mundane. So I would say the biggest inheritor of Frank's aesthetic are the street photographers that really emerge in the 70s and 80s. Vivian Meyer, Gary Winogrand, Joel Meyerowitz, Helen Levitt, I can go on and on, Deanne Arbus. These are people who just looked at the mundane and try to find things to capture in the mundane. And I think that is really where Frank's legacy was embodied. I think today, as I was saying earlier, we all carry around very sophisticated cameras with us. And you can ask, well, we're taking pictures of everything and circulating everything. Has the mundane become mundane? And that's a question I ask in my recent book on death, which is, you know, have the images of, for instance, one of the things I look at is the constant circulation of traumatic scenes. You know, I look at the image of a young boy who was washed up on the shore in Turkey because his family was trying to migrate to Europe. Mm-hmm. I talk about the images circulated around police killings of young black men. And have these images been circulated so much to the point where we don't really empathize with the suffering? And that's a very real question. Right? Because you can say the opposite, which is that the circulation of these images have galvanized people to take to the streets, you know? But I think in many ways, we're living in an era of capture. And I love that you use the word capture. And I think because we have a capture instinct, you know, everyone's on their phones, that we can, on the one hand, be lost in that sort of sea of images. But I think in many ways, we still have that these images, oftentimes, not because the image itself is poignant, but because how they become distributed, how they're used, how they're kind of speaking to certain things are still able to create very important political moments. But I think, you know, that it's a very different era. You know, it used to be that certain images used to kind of create national conversations. We don't have that anymore. We don't, because there's so many of them. But I still think that, you know, think about Instagram. I mean, we're looking at images all the time. So there are, you know, as scholars like to say, there are affordances of technology, but there are also limitations of technology. And we are now realizing that we almost have to live with both. You know, we can't, the thing that kind of frees us also ensnares us. And I think we just have to be aware of that.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. And I actually, your insight here, because I think one of the things I don't appreciate photography sometimes maybe as much as the art form, it's just one of the ones which I haven't probably focused on as much. The idea of looking at it in terms of that snapshot of that moment, I think that framing is a good way to maintain that memory in your head. You're not just looking at colors, looking a certain way, you're looking at a snapshot of a moment, which, I looked at the book. I think the Americans could be a good starting point for me to start to appreciate photography.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Awesome. Well, I guess that's about it. We've gone on, I feel like we've gone on forever, but we should call it there. Anything, I guess, at the end here you want to shout out in any way? I'm not sure if that's putting you on the spot, any websites or anything at all.
Yeah, well, you can, you know, I take photographs. I have an Instagram, my Instagram, and I'll send this to you via text, but it's instagram.com/dolo.graphs, DOLO.graphs, GARPHS. So yeah, that's where my images are. It's linked on my website as well. So yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'll check that in the show notes too. Okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Sam Hahn. That's been really fun. Thanks. Like, really interesting.
Happy to, George.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.